All views expressed by the host or guests are solely their own opinions. Nothing stated in this podcast should be considered a specific endorsement to make any particular investment or follow any specific strategy.
Welcome to All in Bitcoin. Jack, I've spent hours diving into your work, and while you have shared a lot about decentralized medicine, today I want to focus on your path as a Bitcoiner. Ready?
Yeah.
You call yourself a Bitcoiner. Why? What's your definition of a Bitcoiner?
Someone who's a freedom maximalist who believes the most valuable asset is time.
And why do you call yourself a Bitcoiner?
Because Bitcoin's a time machine. That's what it's based on. It rejects the idea of seconds, minutes, and hours for 10-minute blocks. And because it's adopted Newtonian physics as part of the algorithm, that's how you get cause and effect. It's how you build a ledger. It's how you solve the Byzantine general's empire, problem. And when you see that, you begin to realize that there is no out card in the Bitcoin algorithm. It is what it is. Tick tock, next block. One of my friends who's a Bitcoiner, he wrote a book. I think it's beautiful. It says, money you can't fuck with. And that's really, truly what Bitcoin is. And anybody who's hardcore, who understands how money is failing through inflation, what is inflation? It's time theft. What is mitochondrial problems? Time theft. So this is how decentralized health and wealth are linked. They're linked through time. And time determines how energy flows in a system. And we know that the energy for Bitcoin is through the AC power grid, the DC electric current that goes into ASICs. But people don't really look at Bitcoin, I think, fundamentally the way I do. I look at it as a thermodynamic story that when you have a decentralized network that operates like this, external influences can affect it. What makes me a Bitcoiner? Is because it's a decentralized network. And I understand decentralized networks really well.
Yeah. Are you spiritual?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm in the process right now of writing some very powerful blogs. And in the in this series that I'm in, I'm already up to like 55 in decentralized medicine. But I've used, you know, the picture that I've used the most is the center panel of the Sistine Chapel. When Adam reaches out to man, I should say Adam reaches out to God and the finger is not bent. And I've made the comment that everything about health and everything about Bitcoin is in that small little piece of white plaster.
Enlighten me.
Well, if you think about it, this is how the power of light, if no matter what religion you are, you know what the story in Genesis is. Let there be light, right? And it goes all the way down. What do you, when you get to 115 in Genesis, what are you left with? This story is really great. I believe it. But you know what the problem is? What's the recipe? Like, God doesn't tell you the recipe. You have to figure it out. And Bitcoin is the same story. We know the endpoint of Bitcoin, but when you look at Bitcoin in the beginning, it's electricity that's also goes into a semiconductor that turns into light. And that light that we talk about there, that's orange light. That's the light that Max Kaiser likes to be in. It's the light that Michael Saylor likes to be in. And the point that I would make to you, that light is fundamental to this story. And I enjoy teaching Bitcoiners that they're right about Bitcoin. They made the right choice. But if you made the right choice in the finance side, but not on the health side, what good is it to be wealthy if you don't have the wisdom of nature also built into this story? And where does that filter down? Like, where do you distill that to? That's a story of time. So I teach people fundamentally about time. If you want to know what my job is as a Bitcoiner, my job as a neurosurgeon is exactly the same thing. I am a metronome. I like to teach and talk about time. And every time I've been to the Sistine Chapel, I see Bitcoin. I see nature in that little sliver. And I use that over and over again to explain to people that the story of humanity is between those two fingertips. So I would tell you, I'm spiritual, Christian, but I think the church is just like the central bank, decentralized. So no, I don't like organized religion.
What's your Bitcoin story? Who or what put you in?
It's a story of chaos.
You like those?
Yeah, it was actually a couple of my friends put the idea in my head in 2011. And I reacted just the way Jack Cruz would. You're crazy. You know,
2011, that's pretty early.
Yeah, this is during the great financial crisis. Why? Because I saw a lot of changes happening in my practice. And I was concerned about the TARP, all the things that were going on at that time. But I was lucky to have friends in the financial community because I told you the story with me growing up in New York. So one of my good friends works for Goldman Sachs. So him and I had some very interesting discussions at this time. He's the one that first told me about Bitcoin. But the real actor, the real person that got me thinking about it was Jack Dorsey. Jack Dorsey, one of the cypherpunks, he's a good friend of mine. And he became, you know, a follower and a member. He follows everything that I do. Why? Because with him being a technologist, the technology got him sick. So he reached out to me to help him. And he was the one that kept telling me. And I'm going, I've got some of the smartest people and the best people in my life telling me about this. And I'm acting like I'm smarter than them. So then I jumped down the rabbit hole and I started to read and look. Because remember, at that time, there was no videos on YouTube. There was nothing. And that's when I got into Austrian economics. And I fundamentally began to see a story develop. And I said, you know, I like this. So I made the first investment. And just like every other Bitcoiner, we wish we would have done it earlier, but it was early enough. And I credit my friend at Goldman Sachs and Jack Dorsey as the reason they had the gravity in their experience that got Uncle Jack to embrace the chaos.
We have established that you are intelligent and you have described yourself as a smart ass. What makes you smart?
First principle thinking. Like the people that I admire the most in my life are the people that actually put the proof of work into their thinking. I believe that the smartest people in the world are the people that learn from other people and their mistakes. But they're also the people that don't make the original mistakes because they use the things that we know to be true to figure out the unknown. And that process really was my training as a doctor, where, you know, doctors, they put a lot of facts in your head, but they don't really teach you first principle thinking. My first principle thinking happened in the oral surgery residency and the neurosurgery residency, where they taught me the value of thinking about different scenarios. And it turns out when you think about different scenarios, to try to make, how shall we say, probabilities, you have to start thinking about risk and risk management. If you have a good unified theory, you can predict the unknown from the knowns today. That's what first principle thinking really is. And I will tell you, I am drawn like a bug to a light to people who think like that. Like, to give you a perfect example, so you know who I'm thinking about. In the Bitcoin space, Jeff Booth and Larry Lepard. Those two guys, I think, are the best first principle thinkers in Bitcoin. I would have put Michael Saylor in that group, but I'm a little bit concerned about Michael Saylor recently. I still think he's a great thinker, but I think right now, he's gotten a little bit too high on his own supply, meaning that when you get 500,000 Bitcoin, it kind of changes how you look at the game.
How would you explain Bitcoin to someone who totally depends on institutions?
If their mind's not open, I'm not going to have a discussion with them at all. Have fun staying poor. Remember what Satoshi said. I don't have time to explain it to you if your mind's not open. Now, I'm going to assume with your question, the mind is open. I would use a very simple analogy, and I'd make it for El Salvador. 4 years ago, if you went to Super Selectos, you could fill the grocery basket up very, very easily. Today, it's very, very sparse. And you're in a country that has both American money and Bitcoin. Now look at the difference of what Bitcoin has done. When Bukele brought it in, it was $41,000. Now it's $106, $107. So in 4 years, you doubled your money. So that means you have that discussion with people and then you lever it into other things. Like, you can't work for me unless you have a wallet. When somebody comes to me and says, give me a bank transfer, I fire them. So this is where I really appreciate Jack Mallers. Jack Mallers came out about a year ago and he goes, look, I'm no longer on a fiat standard. I am on 100% Bitcoin standard. So if you want to build a world that is Bitcoin, then you need to act like Bitcoin. Michael Saylor's come off of that. He's now telling you, I'm going to custody my Bitcoin with centralized entities. No. The single most important thing for first principle thinking in Bitcoin, if you don't self-custody the Bitcoin, that's a big problem. Michael Saylor's kind of like this. And the second big issue that he's kind of like this, this is my friend Parker Lewis, who is, you know, the CEO of Unchained Capital. We had a dinner together, me, him, and Saylor, about a year ago, about this very issue. And Parker believes that Bitcoin is money and it should be transacted. You know that my friend Jack Dorsey has come out recently and said the same thing. Bitcoin is money and it will be money someday. And anybody who tells you that, no, we're going to make the American dollar king in the future and we'll just back the bonds with it, like, that's good for now, but that's not going to be good for the world down the road. And we see it a different way than the guy who owns the most Bitcoin in the world. And the reason why I'm smiling is because I hope Bitcoiners hear this and see this. Just because he's no longer your Uncle Mike that's doing everything you want, he's still part of the family. Like, you have to realize there's people in your family, you know, I don't want to spend too much time with them, but I enjoy this, that, and the other thing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you see Bitcoin primarily as a store of value or as a medium of exchange, and why? You told me already you see it as medium of exchange.
But can both, to be honest, I think one goes with the other. You know what I think it's? The analogy I would give you, and hopefully you don't get too upset with me, I think it's like sex. Can you have good sex if one person can't have sex than the other? It could still be good, but is it the best? No. And I think Bitcoin's the same way, that you have to have both for it to truly do what it does. Now, do I understand that when Bitcoin is money, that it can put strain on the politicians, like in the United States, who have a hegemony? Can that also affect Bukele here, or say people in Colombia who have a dollarized economy? No question about it. But people don't like to ask the flip side of this. See, that's what our first principle thinker does. If you only do it as store of value, I tell you that's a half truth. And what does a half truth always lead to? A full lie down the road. And remember, Bitcoin's got a story of future till 2140. And I think when you understand that, maybe right now the politicians of the world are not ready for it to be money. But as Jack Mahler said, Bitcoin doesn't care what you think. And it's going to happen one way or the other. And the thing that I love about Bitcoin is that there's places for Michael Saylor, there's places for Jack Dorsey, there's places for me, there's places for you, there's places for a dentist that has no Bitcoin who's going to listen to this and go, you know, I need to examine this.
What's the lesson that's taking you the longest to learn?
You got to get rid of anchors in your life early. Cut your losses early. There's a saying called via negativa. Cut the superfluous. Why? Sometimes, even people that you love, you have to get rid of them. They will impede you going where you have to go. And it's a very difficult thing to do. And unfortunately, it was very easy for me because of how I grew up. See, for me, the lesson started with my own family. But the people who are in my circle of six, you know, the other 12 eyes that I rely on to watch my back when I can't watch it, to see them go through life and to see how the anchors affect them, ultimately, I tried to explain to them that affects me indirectly because you're in my circle of six. And that's a very difficult discussion to have with people that you care about. Like I have it with my son. My son is very smart like I am, but he's very different because he's not a great white shark. And he trusts far too much. And I told him it's good to be trustful if the people are truly thinking first principles. But when you know somebody's not in first principles, look, I can enjoy the time that we spent together. But if I get the sense that you're not my kind of people, I'll be kind to you and that's it. But I don't want to spend time with you. The reason why is I don't trust a lot of people until I really vet them. Like I can have an ambient awareness of you from social media, even if you're one of my paying customers. But until I really know you, until I understand the dynamics in you, I can't bring you close. Mm-hmm. I cannot.
Fair enough.
And this is something that I can tell you I learned as a little boy in New York. Like when you are poor and you grew up in the richest city in the world, let me tell you something. You learn on the concrete the rules of the jungle really fast. And I will tell you, that's the reason why I wouldn't trade how I grew up for $1 million because it really has served me very, very well, you know, in my years. But do I understand that when you look at that sparkling diamond, that it's not as shiny? Because I understand why people like the vanity, like the facade, like the surface story. I told you a little bit about that when Mr. Strelson sent me to Barney's. So I understand that and I can empathize with you, but I am going to force you to really look in the mirror and say, first principle thinking is even more important than that. And I will tell you, with my circle, that is the toughest lesson to teach. And it's really difficult to have some of those conversations, especially when sometimes they're life and death situations.
How come death or life situations?
Well, I'll give you a perfect example. My son was offered a job where he can make a lot of money, but he had to go to Canada. That means he had to take a shot.
Uh-huh.
So here's the decision tree for a kid at the time. He was like 25, 26. I knew his brain wasn't fully myelinated. I'm a neurosurgeon. Did I have confidence he was going to make the right decision? No. But what else did I have to do as a decentralized savage? He was my little slave all the way up when I was paying his bills. The day that I stopped paying his bills, he became a man. So I can't be his keeper anymore. I have to know the lessons that I put in my son, that he makes the decision that's best. If he makes the wrong decision, am I not going to love him? No. I'm still going to love him, but am I going to be disappointed? Yes. Decisions about family, decisions about where you're going to live, decisions about, I'll give you the toughest one. The toughest one that I've had to deal with in my life was with my ex-wife. Divorcing her, not because I didn't care about her, because I knew she was going to kill herself with the decision she was making around technology. From my wife's perspective, it was devastating to her, the last wife, the wife that I was married to for 25 years.
And what did she do for a living?
She basically took care of Uncle Jack. I didn't let her work because I didn't want her to work. That was my mistake. Okay? Too much comfort. And my daughter's engines come from her mother. And her mother was falling apart. And I knew that I had to make a decision because she wasn't going to change to wake my daughter up. Why? Because at the time my daughter was in high school. She was 18 years old. And
but you told me that your ex-wife took a decision related to technology?
TV, Jerry Springer, not going in the sun, developing diseases she shouldn't have, having surgeries that I don't know about because of these decisions. That's what I'm talking about. Like, these are big things, really big things. And when you understand that you see this person falling apart and that person's engines are in your baby, and your baby loves her mama to the degree that whatever her mama says, she's going to do, that's when the great white shark has to come out. You need to understand that. I'm being very serious about that. You don't have to work to have a technology problem. You just have to go to Starbucks and watch Netflix to have a technology problem. And that is the big risk for the Bitcoiners. Why? Because they have all kinds of money. That means they can do all kinds of toys and games. Toys and games are what gets you in trouble.
You mentioned Bitcoiners are scared of you.
I don't think they're scared of me. No. They can't figure me out. Because I'm the antithesis of what the millennials say. I'm a boomer and I was in before them. That pisses them off. But the real big thing is the angle that I come to them with is I'm pointing out to them, even though they think they're in the right game and they make fun of all the boomers who are not in, then I point out to them the guy that was in the beginning of Bitcoin, he's dead. That's Tim Finney, or Hal Finney, I should say. And I say to them, explain. You want to be like him? Because you're going to be. That's when people go, okay. And then when they find out about my friend Jack, he got sick off his own bag, Twitter, technology. Now he's better. So why is Jack, for me, a real big shining light? Because he used my science and he is changing the world in Bitcoin in Asia, Africa, Europe. You see what he's done. He got rid of Twitter, sold it to Elon. He's 100% all in Bitcoin. He got rid of the biggest problem. And everybody told him he was crazy to do this. Was he really crazy? Or was he wickedly smart? That is the people that I want close to me. So you want me to resonate that message? Or do you want me to punch you in the mouth about that message? To wake you up? That is the reason why. Bitcoiners like, Dr. Jack is like syrup of Ipecac. He can make you vomit sometimes. But guess what? No matter how I make you feel, I always tell you the truth. That's the other thing people know about me. I don't bullshit people. I tell them the truth whether they want to hear it or not. So when you hear me say, I'm not everybody's cup of tea, but the savages in Bitcoin, they like to drink my tea.
I would like to know, what scares you?
Well, I think the thing that scares me right now is some of the people that I care the most about, I don't think they're equipped to make the right decisions for the next 50 or 100 years. I'm worried about them. I'm really worried about them. So I think that in trying to help the world with decentralized medicine and teaching people about these diseases, I need to wake some of the people up in my own network. Like, many of them listen to me. They bought Bitcoin early. They're very wealthy now, but they're not making good decisions about other things. And I worry about them.
It scares you because you don't know how to sort it out?
No, I've already given them the big punch in the mouth and it still hasn't worked. So generally when you tell a great white shark this, then the trauma gets bigger and bigger. And I don't know if I want to go that big. Maybe I need to do what nature does or what the Spartan people did when a baby was deformed and leave it on a rock and walk away. But as I told you before, sometimes that's hard with people you care about.
What was your last major confrontation with a Bitcoiner? Who was it with and what was it about?
Maya Paribu in Suriname. It's been well documented through Bitcoin Magazine. I think Frank Corvo has done a good job exposing it. I think what's happened in Suriname since the elections come out proves my point that she was, you know, scamming the Bitcoiners. She's a young girl, very nice. I mean, I like her. I still like her now. But this goes to the Bitcoin ethos that you have to verify, don't trust. So I met Maya for the first time at Adopting Bitcoin recently, very recently. And I spent 3 hours talking to her. And I said, I find you very interesting. She told me she's young. She wants to turn her country around, make it a Bitcoin economy. She wants to use the natural resources. You know, most people don't know Suriname has the largest forest in the world. So, you know, I'm going to love a place like this. Plus, it's low latitude. So it's a good place. It used to be a French colony. So the colonist mindset is still with the people. The Dutch really ruined this place. So that means in that chaos, here comes a lady, knight in white armor. Her father was involved with bad people in the Colombian drug cartel. They killed him. This, to me, was a beautiful story. I've seen myself in her story. And she was going to make good on it. So right after I met her, I decided to go take a trip. I was invited by some of the people in Argentina, the central bankers, to come down about my medical freedom law. And on the process of going to South America, when I came back, I didn't go to that part of South America. And I put a tweet out and Maya sent, why don't you come see me? So I spent 2 weeks in Suriname. Within 24 to 48 hours, I found out that Maya was lying to the Bitcoiners. No one in Suriname uses Twitter. Everybody uses Facebook. So the story on Facebook and the story on X were different. And she was looking to harvest people from X who were Bitcoiners to get money to help her to run. She told everybody she was running for president. It turned out she wasn't. She has deniable plausibility in many of her claims because of the way Suriname is set up. I got to meet her father, or I should say her stepfather, who is a fine person. He explained to me fully, because he knew that I had a lot of reservations about her. And I talked to several of her friends. And then I also went around the country myself to talk to people. And I found out that she's not well known at all. And I said, this is a problem. This is a huge problem. So the last night that I was there, she asked me to speak on her behalf on national TV about something about corruption. So I was like, oh, this is right up my wheelhouse. I'm going to talk about Trump and Bobby and everything else, which I did. Well, I didn't realize that the party that she was working for were the main perpetrators of injecting people in Suriname. So this message, like, she didn't know that I was going to lead with this message, but she also never told me that the NPS party were the main vaccinators for the WHO in Suriname. And it actually happened in the building that I was being interviewed. So, of course, the guy who's the party president had a huge problem. They pulled me off the stage on live TV. Okay? When that happened, I said to my nurse, I can't get on the plane tomorrow fast enough to get out of here, because once you verify that someone is not who they say they are to Bitcoiners, my belief is you have a duty to tell the Bitcoiners what you found. Like, she invited me to go to Suriname. This will show you how crazy she was. A guy like me coming down there, you don't think I'm going to be able to diagnose the problem and figure it out? Well, I was. And it ended the way it should end. maybe somewhere down the road, she'll be a candidate. In my opinion, she has to have a personality change and a thinking change. She's not a first principle thinker, but there are so many broken ties there that I don't think, I don't like to say never, because I believe in redemption. I believe in second and third chances. And I do think there's a lot of redeeming qualities about Maya that I still like. But when you're a liar, it's really hard to regain the trust. Suriname, it's kind of crazy that it's on planet Earth, because when you go there, you feel like you're on a totally different planet. What I saw there was the most magical story ever. The things that I found down there for decentralized medicine, I think there's answers in that jungle for people that took the jab.
You are a person that have traveled a lot.
Yeah.
But still, you are quite taken by that country. What's the situation?
The country, I would tell you, if Bitcoin ever did take over there, this would be a great place to live. Why? Because it's a forest. 93% of the country is forest, untouched. The natural resources are there. They have tons of gold, tons of oil. I mean, this would be a paradise. But the monarchy makes the colonist mindset in the people. When the Dutch pulled out, they imported in their history five different groups of people to the country and then walked away in the 1970s. So, you know, this country has been a mess since that time. So this is like when centralization pulls the plug, they know that even though they're not really in control, they still are, because all of the networks, they still control. That is still present to the day. If you want to know the real business of Suriname now, they launder money for the cartels and send it to Netherlands. That's really what I found when I went down there. Not supposed to really talk about it, but that's the truth. And the reason why the government is going to be broken is because the people in the government, they're all criminals. They're as big a criminals as the people we have in DC, but they're more overt about it. And it's more accepted down there than it is in the United States. The people that are in the jungle, they don't have any monarchy mindset. They've never been ruled by the monarchy, because the monarchy didn't even know these people existed, because they were so far in the jungle. You couldn't find them.
So they are the solution.
Oh, I think so.
Millions took the COVID vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
What's your best advice to help them recover and heal?
That one's simple. What does it fundamentally do? The Department of Defense and the Pentagon engineered the vaccine so that it has a positive charge on the lipid nanoparticles. That means that that charge is drawn to your inner mitochondrial membrane. So it creates a short circuit, like a scar. The damage that it causes is a scar that you can't see, but you see it in the disease you get, like myocarditis or turbo cancer, or, you know, cognitive haze, things like that. That means that you need to optimize light, water, and magnetism to fix it. So what do? You live inside the Tropic of Cancer or Capricorn, somewhere there, and live in nature, connected to the ground, connected to the sun, connected to the darkness. You eat the food that grows there. You turn off all the news. You don't listen to anybody out there. You buy Bitcoin. You buy a convertible. Drive around in the sun. You drink deuterium-depleted water and enjoy people in your life that add time to your bank account. Subtract the people out who are the anchors. That's the answer.
You've mentioned ivermectin, and I also heard of the McCullough Protocol. How do they work?
Well, the McCullough Protocol, in my view, I gave him credit in the beginning that I thought it was a good thing. Now I don't believe that. Now the aftermarket data is out. Getting rid of the spike protein is a pipe dream. You're always going to have it. So that means that you have to mitigate and understand mitochondrial biology really well. Dr. McCullough doesn't understand that as well as I do. Not even close. But the real key with ivermectin can help, because it's one of the things that diminishes that electric scarring that can happen. So that's why it's a benefit. It's also the reason why hydroxychloroquine is a good thing. It's the reason why for some patients, even methylene blue can help in those cases. But the doctor has to understand the process that I just told you. It's not for everybody.
Is there a way to know if you are free from the vaccine's effects?
Yes. The COVID virus itself, the way it was engineered by Barrick and Fauci, your risks, because remember that virus, if you had COVID like 3 or 4 times, you have to be concerned because you're making spike protein, but from the virus. But compared to the vaccine, so we're clear, it's 25 to 100 times worse if you took the vaccine. Every time you take a vaccine, that number goes up. Okay. So if you took 8, you're in big trouble. Okay. What should everybody do today? LabCorp in the United States, you can check your spike protein levels. I think it's only $69 at LabCorp. I believe you can make that test, get the number. When the doctor gets the number, that tells us what your risk is. Now, you have to remember, we don't have a lot of data to make a plot to know. So what am I telling you right now? This is my speculation based on how well I know the science, know the patents, know exactly what the damage profile is. But basically, the higher that number is, the more risk to your mitochondria in different parts of your body. So you need to build up your internal redox. What is that? Your battery. It's the net negative charge in your body. Charge in quantum mechanics is a conserved quality. So that means the more highly charged you are, the longer you can stay away from the complications. So remember before I told you that death is the slowest form of health you create, right? Same thing is true with this. So the game for people who have been vaccinated is you need to improve your redox. The best way to do that is through sunlight and water. The water is deuterium depleted water, and sunlight obviously is stronger inside the tropics, which is why I told you you want to do that. Plus you get light stability. You know, like when you're in Spain right now, sometimes it stays light out till 10 o'clock. That never happens in Salvador. We only get maybe a half hour more because it's 12 hours of light, 12 hours of darkness. And it turns out that light stability is really important for you staying healthy.
You wrote the Public Health Freedom Act for the Salvadoran Constitution in 2023. Mm-hmm. Can you briefly explain what it is and whether it has been passed?
Everything that's wrong with the United States is in that bill. And that's the reason Bobby Kennedy was interested in it. The problem was when it was given to the government here, you'd have to ask the government what they've done with it. But from what I've heard through the grapevine, they're not very excited. Politicians, not meaning Bukele. When you use decentralized money, you're giving power back to the people. Decentralized medicine does the same thing. You're giving freedom of time back to people. When I gave it to the president, I told his brother, same thing I'm going to tell you now. This is my gift to the people of El Salvador. You do what you want with it. Well, I feel any differently whether you pass it or not? No, I don't care. But I thought it was extraordinary that President Bukele invited a foreigner to his house to have this discussion for 3 hours and asked me to write the law. No one in my government asked me to do that. Bobby did steal the law, but he never asked me to write it. He certainly not asked my help. If I was in Maha, there'd be a lot of bodies. That I can tell you. I would not put up with this.
Can you briefly explain what it is about?
The number one thing is lights. Getting rid of LED lights and bringing back incandescents. Mm-hmm. No fluoridation of the water. We have no fluoridation here of water. Why? Because it's expensive. But also, you can't have the use of technology anywhere around the school. So there are not going to be any screens, right? People don't like that. There's going to be books. We're going to go back to the way it used to be. And you know that President Bukele likes to give kids computers. And I told him, I said, I'm okay with you giving the kids computers because I think you can still live with technology well in El Salvador. Why? Because it's 13th latitude. The kids can offset that. Other changes, the vaccine, you can give up to 6, okay? But it has to be in consultation with the doctor and the parent. Also, the child gets a say. Plus, the government cannot get involved in the healthcare system. That, I think, is the big problem for the law. Meaning that if the World Health Organization tells everybody to do this, there is a decentralized loop built in that law where the doctors make the decision, not the government. And the government has to live with the decision. Okay?
How do you handle criticism and pushbacks?
I think I handle it pretty good. I mean, if somebody's got a critique, I always listen. I learn the most from my patients. So remember, many times that can be a critique too. And you filter it into your, you know, your decision tree and then kick it back out and decide, okay, was this a good idea or not?
And what about disappointments? How do you handle them?
It depends. For example, the thing right now, the reason I'm smiling, I'm thinking about like several sports teams that I'm a fan of. They keep failing because their administration, their management is terrible. But everybody thinks they can keep changing the players and the coaches and it will go away. No, the problem is the person that owns the team. You need to get rid of that person. And that disappointment, you know, when you sit there and watch the same shit show for 50 years, you go, you know, it becomes comical. So in my sports life, I make the mistake that I don't make in the decentralized medicine life. I let the anchor pull me down. So that I would tell you, that's why I laughed. But that's not a big thing in life, but it's something I can laugh at now. But I guarantee you, when the games are on TV, I'll be pissed off.
What's your view on Bitcoin's ossification? Is it necessary, inevitable, something we should avoid?
This is a great question. Because you know what? I've asked myself this since I had that dinner with Michael Saylor and Parker Lewis last year. Part of me believes ossifying Bitcoin is a good thing, but I'll tell you how I define ossification. How Bitcoin was originally intended to work. I don't think Bitcoin needs to be anything except a store of value and a medium of exchange. If it does that and that's all it's good at, I'm okay with it. All the other stuff like that, Lightning's working on this and that, I think that's like the whipped cream and the cherry on top of the sundae, meaning having transactions on it. But I believe that Bitcoin is designed perfectly well to do what Satoshi wanted it to do. And I don't think we need to really change that. I don't think we need to make it or modernize it. You know, it's kind of like nature. Nature hasn't changed her recipe for a long time. And it's very, very successful. And ultimately, nature makes things that participated bend to her rules. And I think the way Satoshi designed it is pretty good.
What's one thing about Bitcoin that most people think they understand, but they get completely wrong?
How important self-custody is, and that putting it in your head, the seed phrases, is the stupidest thing ever. Like, you need to have a better plan. I don't think people do a good enough job doing succession planning. For example, the attacks that we just saw in your neck of the woods, you know, in Paris, when the girl, you know, got beaten up. In a world that's bipolar, meaning fiat versus Bitcoin, we're going to see more of those attacks. And, you know, that's another disappointment for me. Because we're successful now, we're going to see more of those attacks. You know, it's kind of like when you have preppers in the United States say, look, if you're the only guy that has Vienna sausages in a can and nobody has food, they're going to come get you. And I don't think people look at it. Like, for example, and I don't know if you went to Vegas or not. People ask me, why didn't you go to Vegas? It makes no sense to go to any Bitcoin conference right now when all the fish are in the barrel for people, especially for the CIA, the FBI, the governments. Because, you know, now they tell you, oh, I'm Donald Trump's son. I'm here to help you. No, you're not. You're not.
What are you saying, that we shouldn't go to conferences anymore?
No, I think conferences in the future should be all online. And the reason why is because, think about it, you're protecting your sovereignty when you do that. There's no reason to have meeting places. I think if Bitcoiners want to meet, it should be on our citadels. We invite the people to our citadels because that way we control, you know, what's going on. I've been invited to go to a lot of conferences, and I'll be honest with you, the older I've gotten, the less of a fan I am of the conferences. It's not because I don't like the people. It's not that I don't want to interact with them live. I just don't want to do it that way. You have to be careful how you live your life going forward. I think in El Salvador, we're very, very safe. I feel safer here than I do in the United States. But to be honest with you, I'm getting ready to travel over to your neck of the woods. My attorney told me, don't fly anywhere in Europe.
Because?
They're afraid some of my tweets would get me in trouble. They're putting people in jail in London right now. You know that, right? So think about it. If you look at some of my tweets that I've mentioned about Starmer, King Charles, and Macron and his husband, you'll understand the reason why it's a big issue. And do I think those issues are going to be magnified in the future? Yeah, because you remember, as you have nation-state adoption, the stakes of the game go up. You know, you just move from the blackjack table to the baccarat table. And you know when the money is a big deal? That's when the game changes. I mean, you saw the other day on Twitter, the CIA put a tweet out. The CIA is now on X. What does that tell you? I mean,
we're watching you. Yeah. You're passionate about decentralized money, army, medicine, and education. In your world, is there still a place for traditional centralized governments? And if so, what role do they play?
I think there is. And I think those are going to be the people that really don't value sovereignty. In other words, they're like Michael Saylor's story about Bitcoin now. For example, I'm the king of Spain. I have so much money. If you want to centralize the government, I'm okay with it. Okay? Michael Saylor believes he's got enough now that he sees the benefits of doing it a different way. But that's not the way people who are truly valuing freedom see it. And in the world, the one thing I love about the world, I look at every country and every culture very, very differently. Like, and living in another country, I see it. I see Latin women, the way in which they run their families, there's so many things I love about it because they're the mama bear. They rule the house. And if people step out of line, she gets them back in line. That's something we lost in the United States. And you don't realize something until you miss it. I'm okay with centralized governments, but in centralized governments, there has to be decentralized savages. Why? They're like the First Amendment in the United States. They're the feedback loop. When the government gets too crazy, the people that are some of the wealthiest people, they have enough money. They say, that's enough. They would be the police state. In other words, they would be so powerful. And when I mean police state, I mean this metaphorically. They don't have to have the guns, but if they need to go get the guns, they got the money to do it and they can take the government out. But as I said to you before, there's no past, there's no future, there's now. Decentralized savages know that. Humans have to make that determination. What do they want their government to be right now in this moment? So for example, people in France, people in UK, they have chosen fascism. They have chosen communism. The biggest irony, the best thing about Europe now, and my eyes were open to this. I went to Bitcoin Prague last year, and these are people that were formerly communist. They are the most free thinkers that I found in Europe. I found brothers from another mother in Czech Republic. Why? Because they know the problem, because they lived through it for 70 years, and they look at people in France, Spain, UK, and they laugh. They're like, let these people, you want to know how they're going to learn? Become communist. Go back to the monarchy. Go back to feudalism. You'll get your cure, and you'll realize that how much you have to fight to get your freedom back. Am I okay that there's people in Vermont that think Bernie Sanders is a great guy? I don't have any problem with that, but just don't ask me to come and talk in Vermont. I don't want to talk to people whose mind's not open, who already decided that it's okay to give the government your freedoms for security. No, I believe what Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson said. You make that trade, you always lose. I don't think that we need to change governance. I just think that we have to have a freedom tool that people can default to so that when it gets really bad, you can pick your ball and go make a soccer game somewhere else.
You said Bitcoiners are building borderless countries with citadels to protect ourselves and even a decentralized army. How does this look like in practice?
Well, for me, I'll tell you how I see it. I see it the way the American Revolution unfolded. A bunch of British people who are misfits, who wanted to worship God their own way, didn't want to pay tax, wanted to come to the New World and farm. And then when the king said, no, we want you to worship our God, we're going to tax, and we're going to tax your tea, the people put the pitchforks down and shot at the king. That is how I see Bitcoiners. Now, the difference back then, they used muskets and they really shot the king. This time the bullets, they're electromagnetic bullets. They're orange. They're Bitcoin. When you have enough freedom, nobody can tell you what to do.
Okay, a few final questions. Your favorite quote?
Run your own race. Don't live anybody else's life because it's the total point. If you're not good enough for yourself, who are you good for?
Yeah. What keeps you grounded?
The way in which I think.
What do you want your legacy to be?
I don't care. Legacy is for the future. That's for other people to decide. It's not my job. My job is to do what I need to do right here, right now. And it updates every day the sun rises. When I see the sun, it's a new day. That's hitting the default button again. Brand new life.
What's one thing you would like people to remember from this conversation?
Off the cuff, brutal honesty.
Thanks, Jack. I've learned a lot. Where can people follow you and your work?
On social media, at Dr. Jack Cruz. There's a lot of scammers out there, so don't get pulled in by them. If you want to learn about decentralized medicine on your own, you can do it free. On my website, I have a form. It'll take you 10 years to read everything on there, but it's free. And then if you want, how shall you say, more focus, like a magnifying glass, it's Jack Cruz DIY on Patreon. And then if you want more of my time, you pay, you become a member. And if you really want a lot of my time, then you pay me in Bitcoin to be your doctor, and I will allow you to rent my brain for your problem.
It's been amazing having you on the pod. Thank you.
No problem.